Hello, and welcome to Speaking in Maine on MPBN Radio. I'm Jonathan Woodward. Today we go to Waterville and Colby College for a panel discussion on civil discourse in politics. The discussion is presented by the Colby College Goldfarb Center for Public Affairs and Civic Engagement. On the panel are Ethan Strimling, former Democratic State Senator and Executive Director of Learning Works, Rachel Talbot Ross, President of the Portland Chapter of the NAACP, Heidi Schott, Canon for Communications and Social Justice for the Episcopal Diocese of Maine, Michael Franz, Associate Professor of Government and Legal Studies at Bowdoin College, and the program is moderated by Dan Shea, Director of the Goldfarb Center for Public Affairs and Civic Engagement at Colby College. The program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time. The program will also be archived on our website, mpbn.net. Click on Audio on Demand to hear the program again at your convenience or to access this and many other past Speaking in Maine programs. The program will also be available as a podcast.
Hello, good evening to our audience here at Diamond Hall on the Colby College campus and listeners on MPBN Radio. Welcome. I'm Dan Shea, Director of the Goldfarb Center for Public Affairs and Civic Engagement and a professor of government here at Colby College. A few years ago, a seasoned Republican political operative, a former Reagan speechwriter, and a Wall Street Journal commentator, Peggy Noonan, wrote that it's a mistake not to see something new, something raw and bitter and dangerous in this particular moment that we're in. She was referring, of course, to the rise of rude, nasty, stubborn politics. Shortly after Noonan made this comment, a series of polls were released suggesting that Americans are deeply concerned about the tone of politics. While 94% of Americans suggest civil dialogue, civil politics is important in our democracy, a full two-thirds believe we're headed in the wrong direction. Things are getting worse. Americans are increasingly worried about the way we conduct our democracy. How did this happen? What's been the causes, the implications? Is there anything we can do about it? Have we seen this type of nasty, vitriolic politics in Maine? If so, are there steps that we can take to turn things in a different direction? These are important. These are big questions. Thankfully, we have a distinguished panel to help us wrestle with these questions and others. So we'll go down the left. If you don't mind, I'll introduce Ethan Strimling, former Democratic State Senator and Executive Director of Learning Works, Rachel Talbot Ross, President of the Portland Chapter of the NAACP, Heidi Schott, Canon of the for Communications and Social Justice for the Episcopal Diocese of Maine, Michael Franz is an Associate Professor of Government and Legal Studies at Bowdoin College, and Carol Connolly is the Executive Director of the Christian Civic League of Maine. I will be the moderator for tonight's chat. Our plan is to open with a few questions. I'll ask a few questions, and the panelists will order them in no particular order. Then we'll turn the microphone to the audience, where you have a chance to ask your questions. I will ask that as you ask your question, that you do use the microphone, because, again, this is being recorded for MPBN. Let's start off with a basic question. Let's do some groundwork first. How would we define civil? What's civil and what's not? What's a negative ad? What's a comparative ad? What's an attack below the belt? And what's simply a good hard hit? What is it that's uncivil about our politics these days? And I would open it to the panel. Anyone like to jump in and start things? Michael, you're on the spot. I've called on you.
Well, I don't exactly know how I would uniformly or at least consistently define civility in our politics, in part because I find in my own scholarship on the issue of civility and political advertising, which is my focus, we have a hard time getting people who code the ads for us and put them into different categories agreeing on what that means. We do have a better understanding, however, of the more general categories of what it means to be negative or comparative, to speak to Dan's initial question. We generally see negative ads as ads that strictly focus on the opposition, which is, of course, a broad category that could include civil and uncivil attacks, that could include policy-based or personal attacks. And we code ads or see ads that mention yourself as a candidate and the opposition as contrast ads, and you'll almost always find candidates arguing that contrast ads are not negative ads. However, you very rarely say something nice about your opposition. And so I work in the realm of the objective in that sense by looking at advertisements that fit those basic criteria, and I find it very hard to understand what rises to the definition of civility. It's a concept that we all find in its broad sense attractive and useful, but what counts in that category can be very difficult to operationalize.
Not to venture into the obvious, but I think fairness certainly is a part of that. I think of political campaigns of individuals that I actually supported, and to hear them talk of their opponent when they had a certain vote that wouldn't have been a popular vote, but then later on supported maybe a conservative cause, but yet they still would call that person liberal, knowing that they'd actually supported a conservative cause. I certainly think that that's not fair. It may be factually true, but it's unfair. So to just throw that out there, I think it's an obvious, but I think fairness, certainly beyond the respect, I guess, of civility would be part of that.
Great. I want to backtrack just one quick second. I would be remiss if I didn't mention, for those of you here in the audience, you can see that as co-sponsored, tonight's event's co-sponsored the Goldfarb Center and the Maine Council of Churches, but those on the radio can't see that. So I wanted to make sure that I thank the Maine Council of Churches for helping out with tonight's event. Okay. Are we less civil than we used to be? Is that a given? I mean, America's politics has always been rough and tumble. It's not beanbags. Is Peggy Noonan really right? Have things become raw, bitter, particularly nasty, dangerous, she says? Are things worse?
I think with social media and the way our lives have changed around electronics, that it's become easier to not know the people you're attacking if it is a negative and non-civil ad or any kind of, it's easier to tweet something that goes out to the world because there's nobody really at the other end. You're not across the table looking at someone. In a world where we need emoticons to be able to tell what we intend to say or how the mood or the tone we intend to convey, that's not necessarily a very civil world where you need something as artificial as a smiley face to tell somebody, oh, I was just kidding, I was just joking. So I think in the church we have things called sins of omission and sins of commission. And I would say in the advertising, it's really up to the person on the receiving end to have a sense of what's not being said here. I mean, I think to be to live in a civil society means that you have to be willing to take the responsibility to, that doesn't smell right. If it seems like maybe how another candidate's being characterized doesn't sound quite right, maybe there's more to the story. I think it's up to the citizen to be the one to try to find out more about it. I think we really have, as social media and electronics have taken over our lives, I think it's become, we've stepped away from the responsibility of being good citizens.
Okay. Ethan, you have a thought?
I want to thank you for inviting me, and I'm glad to be here and have this conversation. I actually have this battle with my father all the time. He's a baby boomer and sort of grew up in the, just after the Depression. And we have this conversation about what politics used to be like versus what it is today. And what we sometimes do is we have our own little book club, and we love to read about Lyndon Johnson, or we were reading this book called Fear Itself, which was about FDR and what was going on then in terms of trying to pass a lot of the legislation that FDR was trying to get through, and the battles that he had at that time with the Southern Democrats, who, really very reactionary, very regressive politics back then. And it really did strike me how remarkably similar it was. And I very much resist that we are in some different era. It may be condensed, we may be ideologically more divided in some ways, but there was this whole chapter in the book about trying to pass anti-lynching laws back in the 1920s and 1930s. And if you read that, there is nothing that happens today in politics that comes close to how awful that battle was, and they did nothing, right? I mean, year after year, as hundreds of people were being lynched in this country, much like, for me, the gun violence that we see today, and we see a government that refuses to act in any way, shape, or form. At that time, there was a government that refused to react in the face and admitted it, that it was happening, and found every excuse in the book and found every way to insult the opposition. And I think if we look through history, you just see those moments. And it's change is hard. And when you are trying to change, those who are in power do not want to give it up. And whether it's the Affordable Care Act or whether it's the Civil Rights Act, or the war on poverty, or whether it was anti-lynching laws in the 1930s. It's hard and nasty, and it gets brutal. So I don't know that today is actually that different. I think it's just part of how our politics, part of change and taking power and making progress.
Rachel, you had a thought on that?
I did. I just wanted to add to the last two comments and say that in this age of technology where we are inundated 24 hours a day with news, the news has now become just whatever's the most sensational. So it is that's what plays over and over and over again. The person who throws the muddiest, shot is what we see. And we retweet and replay over and over and over again. So I would agree that it's not any worse than it was in any other period of time. We go through these peaks and valleys of civility, and we wrestle with our First Amendment rights and what is free speech and what has now violated some kind of speech code or code of ethics. So we go through this from time to time. It's a fluid thing. But today seems more particularly harmful in our civic discourse because of the sensationalism of news. Everything is breaking news. Everything is breaking news.
Right. And honestly, that's why I mentioned when I introduced Peggy Noonan, I suggested that she was a seasoned political operative. She's seen a lot of campaigns. She's done a lot of work. And she says there's something different. And the fact that we're having this discussion tonight and that most Americans think we're off on the wrong track might suggest, Ethan, that you might be right on one level, but something feels different. I think the audience tonight, there's a lot of nods. So what is it that would feel different? One explanation, Rachel's point's well taken, that things are maybe the same except we hear about it more often. Is there anything else that might be going on?
Yeah, well, I think one of the things that's happening that's different these days is the fact that the major ideologies in our politics, the liberal ideology, conservative ideology, are lining up with the parties much more consistently than they used to. Ethan is right when he points to the sort of effect of the Southern Democrats on the Democratic Party in the mid and early part of the 20th century. And as we move forward into the 20th century, those Southern Democrats declined in number and became Republicans, and the Republican Party became more consistently filled with just conservatives, and the Democratic Party became more consistently filled with just liberals. And so although there has always been a small government, big government, small government, anti-government, pro-government distinction in our political system that has characterized bitter fights and been part of incredible struggles in our political history, there were, for a long time, a fairly good amount of either of those in each party. And now we know quantitatively that that's less so. And so the two parties are more polarized, they're more cohesive in that polarization, and that means that they're increasingly seeing the other side as dangerous for our politics. Democrats can't find much in the small government philosophy of Republicans to like, or many Republicans to like, and the same thing works on the other side. And so that ends up, I think, fostering a bitterness and a vitriol to some extent was weakened in the aggregate when there was a bit of cross-pollination across both parties.
I would say, Dan, as an old history teacher, it'd be hard to say that we are more vitriolic than we have been at any other time. If you read the pamphlets of, the late 1700s and the early 1800s, incredibly personal attacks that had nothing to do with the issues at the time were very much part of that. So I guess the question I'd ask, and something I'm sure we'll be wrestling, is it relevant to whether it was or wasn't isn't? If we are committed and trying to get other people to commit to being civil, I don't know how relevant is, how can we really measure that when we say, well, we feel like something's different, when we can clearly look to other times in the written word where it was just as, if not more personal in the attacks that in our political realm.
But without the 24-hour news cycle.
Right. A pamphlet lasted as long, but didn't get out there as quickly.
Yeah. I'm reminded when I was thinking about this and the snow, you mentioned in some of the material that came ahead of time, the Snow-Dashlin-Lott Commission report. And it reminded me of a book that came out in 2008 called The Big Sort by Bill Bishop. Yeah. And I looked at some of the maps today about congressional districts that were, or actually counties across the United States, that were 20% in the 1976 election, presidential election, 20% or more that went Republican, or 20% more went Democrat, and then ones that were, there was not to that extent. And then if you look at the 2004 presidential election, everywhere across America, except Maine, actually. Maine went to having no counties at all that were 20% more or less for one of the two parties. But across the rest of the country, particularly the Middle West and the West, there's this huge polarization. And he talks about it in the book of, you know, people moving to where people believe like you do. I mean, I think that, and people listening to news sources. I mean, I can go to my in-laws' house any day of the week and Fox News is on, absolutely. And that is how they're hearing it. I know a lot of people that only listen to Rachel Maddow. And so I think that's something, not only where we live and how we vote. Also, Slate had a piece in the summer about gerrymandering, where you could do a jigsaw puzzle. You should go and look it up. Do gerrymandering on Slate. You could do a jigsaw puzzle, for 5 states, and how ridiculous some of the gerrymandered districts are. In Maryland, the 3rd district, it's either compared to a broken-winged pterodactyl or a blood splatter of a crime scene. I mean, it's the most ridiculous congressional district you can imagine. And so I think that's a piece of it. I think we're isolated in terms of we want to listen to only people on our news feeds and Facebook who believe the way we do, or we want to listen to a news source that just backs us up in what we already suspect.
Well, Heidi, let me pick up on that, if you don't mind, one second, Ethan, because one of our students is actually doing research on this Big Sort phenomenon. So we're so glad you brought it up. And Ethan, maybe you could comment first. It is rather controversial. What the argument of the book is, the argument of sorting, is that Americans are choosing to live with ideologically consistent people. We're finding neighborhoods, states, communities that fit our ideology. Or at the very least, fit our lifestyle, and the lifestyle fits the ideology. Or our religion, and that fits our ideology. Rather, it's controversial. I'd love to hear what the panel thinks about that explanation. And what happens is when you cluster together, you know, you don't hear the other side of anything, and you become nastier and tougher. Maybe Ethan, you could start.
Yeah, I haven't read the book, and so I can't comment on all of it. I certainly am not saying that civility isn't very important in politics, and I do political analysis on TV, and I intentionally partner with a Republican so that we can have conversations, and what we hear about more than anything is that people like that it's two people talking as opposed to MSNBC and Fox News. So don't get me wrong in any of that. I get very skeptical of the good old days kind of conversations, or the bad old days, you know, that it used to be terrible and now it's great, or that it used to be great and now it's bad. Gerrymandering came about because districts were completely excluding people from being able to vote, right? Making sure that black people in this country never had representation. So that's how districts were set up. So if we think districts today are gerrymandered in a way that's crazy, think about what it was before the Supreme Court said you have to change these districts so you have better representation and we have one person, one vote. And that means that in that era, what was going on is that white people wanted to be all together. It may not have been Democrat, Republican. I get that. It may not have been that kind of partisan. But I have a hard time believing that people at that time were just as much saying, I want to live with people who look like me, who think like me, who are wealthy like me, who are working class like me. It wasn't partisan. I get that. We are in a different place there. But gerrymandering came about because we were creating districts that were setting a certain ideology that made sure only a certain people were elected into higher office. So I just think it's important we remember that how we got to the place that we are today.
In regard to the sorting, I think we have, elections have consequences, and we have the ability to cut those out and slice them, so it's not partisan in that regard, like who came up with it, but certainly partisan in the execution of it. And this was not, there was not a racial element in gerrymandering. It was Elbridge Gerry back in Massachusetts, I believe in the late 1700s, early 1800s, that where we got the gerrymandering, but it's clearly political, clearly partisan. But I guess the question I would ask in regard to the sorting, who has the mobility to make that decision? I've not read the book either, so I'm not educated on that. What percentage of us have the ability to make a decision based upon people like us, and how do we know that? How do we know whether people like us? I live in a small town of Glenburn. I don't know really a lot about my neighbors other than
really you don't know the politics of your community. Don't we all know the politics?
Is politics the beginning and the end of the definition of what I am and who I am?
No, I didn't ask that. I'm just wondering, don't we know the politics of our community these days?
I would say we know the politics of our communities in regard to the whole red-blue aspect of that. But I'm not sure that, I guess in my experience, having moved from Massachusetts to Maine a few years ago, and maybe it's over, you know, just looking for myself, that never played into any role other than I wanted to get my children out of exile in Massachusetts and move them back to the hills of Maine and, you know, a good place to grow up. So I've just never met anybody that has said that on political lines.
Others on this or a related topic? Either
well, I also think that the discussion is in some sense is talking about a few different things at the same time. It's true that the partisanship and the polarization between the two parties and ideological coalitions within the parties is more distinct, and that makes our politics look different and feel different than it used to for that reason. But at the same time, if we're going to simply talk about the sort of level of dialogue and the type of angry discussions that we've had throughout our political history, then it's very hard to argue or even compare, perhaps, the different kinds of political eras that we've been through and to make the case that ours is either less, more, or equal because they look so different and they had so many different types of fights. So if we want to talk about partisanship, there's a trend that we can easily identify. If we want to measure and talk about levels of civility over American history, it's as I suggested, I think it's very difficult to actually get us all on board on what that even looks like or means oftentimes because of the difficulties in making these kinds of comparisons across time.
Okay. But you did talk about sort of historic levels of sort of ideological consistency within the party. That's different.
That's different.
Empirically verifiable.
Empirically. And also, I mean, I've studied political ads for a long time, and we keep seeing, I mean, journalists keep saying this is the most negative election that we've ever seen. And I very rarely believe anything a journalist would say in that regard because I'm a political scientist and so I look for data. But they're usually right, whether they mean to be or not, that when you count up the amount of attacks that are in our television political advertisements, or if you say nothing but negative somethings about your opposition, those numbers are on the rise consistently every election cycle. And we're seeing it even in this election cycle early on. Over half of the ads aired can be nothing but negative things about the opposition. And although those are interesting and important things to point out, it is telling that that quantitative measurement shows an increase in negativity over time. It almost seems like a world away that in the 2000 presidential election, a majority of the ads aired in that election were not negative. And that seems amazing to think about, given that the kinds of presidential election dialogues we've had in recent years have been incredibly negative.
And I've got a question for you then. Does your analysis separate out which are PAC ads and which are that are absolutely endorsed by the candidate? And I wonder what that breakdown is.
Yeah.
Because I think that's a big issue that, you know, we're standing here with Maine Council of Churches. That we have a covenant on civil discourse that we're asking, I believe, 435 national, local, state candidates to sign about conducting their campaign in a civil manner. And that's a tough one, because if you have a PAC that's doing an ad on your behalf, that's a much different thing than saying I will vow not to criticize or to be characterize my opponent as evil. But a PAC, ooh, didn't have anything to do with that. So I think that's a really interesting question. I'd be interested in what your research has shown on that.
Well, we've seen that. I mean, not only are the number of outside spending skyrocketed since the Citizens United case in 2000, but those groups that are involved in elections today don't really get involved to say positive things about candidates. There used to be that case because they had to, in many cases, qualify as an issue advocacy organization, and so you aired an ad that thanked somebody for supporting some policy or something, and then you got to promote a campaign and not have to register as a political group. But now there's no restrictions, and so these organizations form ostensibly as wings of the candidates' campaigns, although they can't legally coordinate, and they do nothing but attack the opposition. They can, in a sense, divide and conquer in that way. And so one of the main reasons we're seeing this increase in negativity is because of the presence of these outside spending organizations whose sole purpose is to drag candidates through the mud.
I'm going to put Rachel on the hot spot here, and it's going to be a question that will help me. It's about Maine. I'm new to Maine. I'm here just 2 years. Have things become tougher, nastier in Maine politics, in your view? Has this issue come to our state?
I think the issue's always been in our state. I don't see why now is, again, thinking about our discussion around history, it's not any different. I think there are mechanisms now that put it, again, in our face 24 hours a day, but I don't think that any of the negative comments that we're seeing or negative ads that we're seeing or the ideology wasn't always present. It was perhaps in a boardroom or behind closed doors or over the dinner table at night in different families' homes, but it's always been present. You know, for me, civility is about persuading through reason and debate, and without civility, we have no diversity. You want diverse thoughts, you want diverse thinking, words, deeds, that helps us get to a place of reason. So I don't see it any more negatively today than it was in the past, but I also think that, you know, civility is a norm. It's a value that we as a community either want to respect with some integrity or not. And you can certainly choose not to, but that norm, that the kind of the way we act with one another is totally up to us. So if there's more negativity today, it's totally up to us to be able to say that this is not the way we want our public and civic discourse to take place. And we have the ability to squash it, to do something about it.
Okay. Well, Ethan, yeah, you're the politician, or the former politician. I'm sure all your campaigns were very positive. We all know that. So, yeah, what do you think about this?
I think it's... I certainly agree with Rachel that, you know, maybe part of the distinction here is policymaking versus campaigning, right? That I agree that campaigning, especially with PACs and Citizens United, there's a very negative angle that's coming in there, sort of because I think campaigns have realized that that's an easier way to win. You know, it's not that our country has become less civil, it's that just like Pepsi figured out a new way to market, it uses that new market, and we know that negative, you know, we know that if I say to somebody, you know, your hair looks bad today, you're going to remember that comment a lot longer than if I tell you your hair looks good. And it takes like 10 positive things to offset the one negative thing you hear. We know that. Marketing people know that. So I agree that I think in Maine there is a civility perhaps in the way that we govern. But even that, I look back and again, you know, remember 20 years ago was the only time the government ever shut down. When McKernan had the battle with the legislature over workers' comp in 1992, right, 22 years ago, that was the only time it's ever shut down. It hasn't shut down now. In the time now when we're saying it's really bad and it's uncivil and LePage and Democrats, I can't talk, and they didn't shut down government, but they did in 1992, 22 years ago, when apparently it was more civil. right? Angus King ran ads against Joe Brennan in which he basically had Joe Brennan as a 300-year-old mummy. I mean, walking through the ad. Like, you know, I mean, it was purely a good campaign ad, but very negative and not particularly civil. And that's what we've seen. And Joe Brennan did the same thing with McKernan, and everybody's done that. So I think that we have seen within campaigns that level of civility. The volume is probably not as high. I think that is true. It's obvious there are more means. I heard one very interesting report. I don't remember if it was on Maine Public Radio or National Public Radio, in which they were talking about millennials, you know, wanting to show their pictures of themselves to everybody. And somebody came on and said, that's always been the case, right? When cameras first came about, people, families loved taking pictures and show. The difference was, I have 5,000 friends I can show them to today like that. And in those days, I had 12. But every time I saw my 12 friends, I would show them my pictures because I loved showing them pictures of myself. So millennials are no more self-focused in that sense. They just have more people to show them to because we now have the means to do that.
Okay. Other comments about Maine? And then I'm going to turn it over to the audience for a question. Okay, well, let's do that. Let's turn it over to the audience. And I think our first question is over here. If you take the microphone. Thank you.
Hi, Father Dick Senghaus from Scarborough. Don't you think we should consider what the author, Alexander Solzhenitsyn, said, wrote years ago, I will paraphrase it, that the line between good and evil is not between one country and another, not between one ethnic group and another, not between one race and another. The line between good and evil is within every individual. And just to ask our Franco-American grandparents or Native American grandparents if there was any hatred in Maine a few generations ago. And they will tell you a lot of terrible, terrible examples. It seems to me that the only answer to this is an anthropological answer, and that is we all have this weakness and temptation to do wrong, and the answer to that is a change in how we act toward others with love, with agape, so that we respect them, their dignity, and we learn to love people we don't like, especially if we don't like them, because that kind of love, agape, is an act of the will to wish the good of the other. And that is the only answer to this problem, I think. And it's a problem of basic human nature we have to face, admit, and it's in ourselves as well as everybody else.
Thank you. It's ethics, it's morals that was raised earlier. What do you think, Pam?
Well, it's how Dr. King led, you know, the civil rights movement is through the agape principle of nonviolence, love your enemy, and proven that there was a change could happen by adopting that kind of philosophy. So he went from the pulpit and the sense of both, I am my brother and my sister's keeper, with this concept of agape love to lead a nonviolent social change movement in this country. So there is power in that. I question today whether or not we all even know how to use the same language sometimes to talk about these things, and we get caught up in some language. But I agree with you definitely around this concept of agape love being the foundation for moving us forward.
One commentator did suggest, though, that our capacity for empathy, for seeing the other side, is sometimes shaken when there are disturbances. And the argument that Frank Rich of the Times makes is a disturbance of the economic crisis and demographic changes and social changes. Our world is changing very fast, very quickly. That our ability to do as your father suggests is shaken when there are these changes. Does that make sense? Did Rich have any?
I think the changes, those kinds of changes, if you think about wages in American families have really not changed since the 1970s. I mean, in terms of real money earned, that causes fear. It causes fear to people coming out of college with a lot of debt to be able to wonder how they're going to be able to have the same standard of living their parents have. And I think fear is sometimes a really big motivator there. And if you are siloed with people who only think the same way you do, not to drag that into it again, but then it becomes easier to be angry and fearful and strike out at the other. And that's, you know, people say, well, what role does the church or what role does religion have to play in civil discourse? I think that's why we need to be at the table, because, for example, in the Episcopal Church, our baptismal covenant, that thing that you say when you are baptized or someone says on your behalf and hopefully will train you up the way that you should go, one of the things is the question, will you strive for justice and peace among all people and respect the dignity of every human being? I will with God's help. And that's part of what it means to engage in society. It doesn't mean trying to convert people to the way you think. It means to recognize the common humanity in every person and the spark of the divine in every person, and to say, I'd be speaking against myself if I were not to respect that in another person. I think that's where the agape comes in, that's what it means to be respectful and civil. And I think in the public square, that's where we have a role to play, to say, let's draw people to their better selves.
As I'm thinking of this, I realize that I'm falling into the same trap I do in my classes, which is I tend to convey a lot of depressing information sometimes, and so I think that the that's clearly the answer, and the answer is, it's hard to legislate in any way this kind of cultural, sort of larger cultural change. You know, there's always been bills floating around about, you know, candidates should only air positive ads, and you know, and these are all difficult ways of sort of ramming into our cultural conscience a more civil discourse. What worries me is that a larger trend here, far beyond the political trend of negativity, is a trend that's been noted for a long time, which is the decline of civil society organizations that do these kinds of bridging. You know, Robert Putnam wrote a very famous book almost 15 years ago now called Bowling Alone, about the decline of civil society, and he was tying into the civil nature of our culture in the 19th century when Tocqueville was traveling throughout the country and noted all of the organizations that existed that were bringing different communities and keeping those communities together. And so without those, you know, sort of bridging social institutions that allow people to experience and talk with people who have different viewpoints from them, it's very hard to imagine a change in our cultural environment. So, you know, Ethan's totally right about the sort of comparisons over time. But there's also a point at which the access to technology and the decline in those social institutions together, even though our instincts, our nature is not perhaps changed, the environment we're in can force a change in the outcomes that we experience. And so, you know, yes, it's 5,000 people never saw that picture, that selfie of me, you know, picking a pumpkin. But and maybe, you know, in the 19th century, people would have done the same exact thing. But there comes a point where that technological intervention can actually cause people to behave differently than they would have. And I think that's something of a concern also.
I think that, and I appreciate Father's input into this, that it comes back to, we're talking about what to do. So should we or should we not be civil? And you and I were talking before we started here, who's going to argue that we shouldn't be civil? I mean, the vast majority of time, we may eventually tonight talk about are the times maybe when civility is not the call for the day. But I think, when, as you referenced to Tocqueville, I think we are less civil than we were. I don't know if the politics is less civil, but I think as a society, we are less civil. And I think that something that's, you know, a very controversial talk about was the observation of Tocqueville that the role that the church did play and those organizations played in why we should be civil. Not just keep telling people that we need to be civil, but why do we need to be civil, and not to avoid the spiritual, moral, ethical question that is, one proposal is because of agape love, because every single human being is born with the image of God, and therefore that demands a sacredness of respect and compassion. And I think that is something sometimes in our secular society that's missing, the why as opposed to just the what.
I feel like I appreciate what you're saying, but I think we're more civil today. I mean, I don't know that we're more civil in politics, but we protect people better. People are able to live the life they choose to live. We don't discriminate against, well, we do, but we have laws at least that say you're not allowed to anymore. I mean, to say that we were more civil at a time when blacks and women couldn't vote, I mean, how is that? Maybe we pretended to like each other better. But now, in a very important way in America, we have become more progressive and more strong and more open and more welcoming. We have a long way to go, a long way to go. But for me, and maybe that's the policy side of it, we are a more civil society. We are more open. We are more willing. We are more accepting. And that's what I mean by pretending like it used to be the good old days and it was great. And let's look back at those days and see how divided we really were. The difference is that those who we were uncivil towards had no power and voices weren't heard. The books weren't written about them. We pretend it was this beautiful era. But it was all white guys running government from districts that they created that excluded everybody else. And that, to me, there is no way you call that a more civil era.
Ethan, I don't think it's an either-or proposition. There's no way that we could have the discussion without that very appropriate. I oftentimes, when I'm speaking at churches and involved in the controversy of trying to get people civically engaged, and I know that's another controversy within the church separation and so on with the state, and I always say, don't talk to me from a nostalgic perspective that's talk about how great the 50s were and the 60s were. I talk about growing up as a child in Brownville Junction, and I could go trick-or-treating, and my mother didn't worry about, you know, anything bad happening, but to ignore the injustices that occurred. But at the same time, to recognize the malaise in our society in regard to the violence and those statistics at the same time, I don't see how we could just blanket make the statement that we're either more civil or less civil without considering that aspect of our society and the lack of respect that we have for each other. So I think sometimes we bring out these great injustices and then still ignore the incredible malaise that does exist in regard to violence and safety and those issues.
I wonder if we're mixing our terms here, because while we may be more civil, that doesn't mean we're more just. So you can't just make the quid pro quo that because we're more polite and there's more places for us to expose our differences, that then that equates to justice. You know what I mean? So it's not a quid pro quo. We may be more polite, or we may be just as polite as we used to be, but that you're equating all of that with somehow that there's an equality there, that or an equitable distribution that just doesn't exist.
Well, I don't think I'm saying that there is an equitable distribution. I'm saying that it's more equal than it was. When there was a time when somebody couldn't vote just because they were a woman, fundamentally, we are more equal than that today. When you could fire somebody in the state of Maine because of who they loved 7 years ago, and you cannot do that today, we're fundamentally more civil in that way. So by no means do I mean that we perhaps treat each other more civilly or anything. I think there's still obviously a lot of that, and by no means do I mean there is justice or it is just or equitable. But it is at least, I am glad I live in this era and not at the beginning of 100 years ago when it was, for me, very different.
And for some, you know, African Americans who live in the Deep South right now, it's probably the same experience.
Fair.
Right. Fair. I'm also wondering if we've moved forward in a loving direction in so many areas of our lives and society, if Ethan's right, politics, and perhaps politics stayed the same, but it seems worse, right? Which is your point that we were making earlier, that if we've moved forward in so many directions, why can't we move our politics forward? And that actually helps explain what young people do. And Michael, you were talking, I heard you on the radio the other day, talking about what young people think about service versus politics. So maybe you could...
Yeah, there's some really interesting stuff written about sort of the views of millennials on the issue of citizenship. And so comparing across generations, which is always an interesting analysis, surveys and polling have generally uncovered that many millennials in that generation are increasingly patriotic and see a certain devotion to the United States, but view their citizenship responsibilities in very different ways. So the greatest generation, you know, joined the military and always votes and participated in their community, but always participated also in politics. But increasingly, young people are seeing politics because it's nasty or because, in their view, it's uncivil or doesn't have as much payoff given that environment, view volunteering and participating in their communities as slightly more of a patriotic citizenship act. And voting, actually, when they sort of rank forms of citizenship, voting for millennials is lower down the list than it is for older generations. And, you know, and to some extent, that's a positive to see a continued vibrancy and faith in the community, even at the time that we are seeing a decline in civil institutions across time. On the other hand, a disengagement with politics and policymaking is not a good strategy for, I think, for continuing a vibrant citizenship. I think it has to be a all-of-the-above strategy, to borrow a phrase from the president, with energy policy, you know, where you know, people participate in their communities, start nonprofits, try to make change on the ground, but also remember to vote every single election day. Remember to consider which candidates are for office and to decide that that vote, even if their specific vote doesn't matter, is still important act politically. And so if we see turnout declines amongst younger people, and even as volunteering and commitment to community may be going up, I'm still a little bit nervous about that.
Great. Let's go to the audience again for a question. There's one in the back over here. Oh, go ahead. Sure.
Great. I'm Dr. Bill Barter from the Maine Council of Churches. And I have a question about an ad that's running right now that we hear a lot about. And it's an ad that talks about one candidate who's willing to spend a lot of tax money on what the ad calls illegal immigrants, which is kind of erroneous because they're really referring to asylum seekers who are here legally. They're just caught in a very, very long legal sort of limbo. And so even in this conversation saying that there always has been some negativity, it seems like society must have some responsibility to protect people who are powerless, you know, who are in a sense, quote, you know, collaterally damaged, unquote, by the political process from this negative advertising. I mean, and then I think of the folks that are named in this ad, and by far they are people of color in Maine who are here as asylum seekers. So I mean, I'm curious as to, you know, what responsibility do we have as a society to protect people who are victimized when the discourse becomes less civil or when people get exploited to win an election?
That's a good question. I'm glad I don't have to answer.
we have great responsibility. I mean, I run a place called Learning Works. We work with at-risk kids, and we work with immigrants and refugees, and every day, I know that the story of that ad is completely false and tears down people who are building this state and this country, and it's just the generation today. But as we talk about over time, again, I talk about this just in a comparative way. We have chosen to beat up immigrants for decades in politics, in decade, just over, and whether it was the Chinese or whether it was the Irish or whether it was the Jews or whether it was the Italians or whether it was Asians or today, whether it's people who are coming from Africa, over and over and over again. So it's nothing new, and unfortunately, we have to push back on it very hard.
It's definitely nothing new. I mean, you used to run ads and get away with it by portraying black women as welfare queens and black men as drug addicts and rapists and violent predators. So it's nothing new. I mean, our responsibility is, A, to speak up, and, B, to get the truth out there. And every single person in this room and everyone listening, that is your responsibility. You know it's not true. Speak up. And, you know, the silence allows for that kind of misinformation to be promoted. So when you don't speak up and you don't put out the right facts, you're participating in the proliferation of that stereotype and that prejudice and bigotry. And so, yes, we have a responsibility. Each and every one of us does. I don't have any more responsibility because I'm a black woman than you do as a white man. It's wrong. It should be corrected. And we need to do something about it. Some of us are trying.
Does Maine have a fact check, a ad watch unit in the media to keep an eye on these things?
There is a little bit. The Press Herald or some newspapers, Sun Journal will do some fact check stuff, but you know, it's as we're talking about. You know, fact check in a newspaper compared to an ad that's running with 2,000 points, gross rating points behind it across the state. You know, 2,000 points means the target group is going to see that ad 20 times in a week. So for you to see that ad 20 times in a week versus some little blurb in a newspaper, you know, the best way to counteract it is with other ads that would go against it. But in a campaign, if your polling doesn't tell you that I need to run an ad to counteract that in order to win the race, you're not going to run that ad, because your job in a campaign is to win the race with the belief that if I win, I can go and create different policy that will help the people that are being harmed.
Great. Carol?
In respect to Dr. Bill's question in immigration and then in regard to civility with this issue, my organization, the Christian Civic League, is actually part of a national organization, and it's focused on the family. And the director focused on the family has really very challenged evangelicals, conservative evangelicals, that, you know, if we believe in focus on the family, does that just mean American families? Does that not mean Mexican families or anybody else that that we see their plight and who wouldn't want to live here, and to really rethink that and not get caught in the lines? So I can tell you that within, you know, as I guess kind of a conservative on this panel and giving that perspective, I know it's one that is being wrestled with right now about how does that fit. But at the same time, in regard to the discourse around this issue, I've heard nobody, or very often, if somebody brings up legitimate questions in regard to our resources, limited resources, or our security around the border, that they are automatically labeled someone that hates people and doesn't care about their plight, rather than having a civil, effective discourse about it, and maybe even drawing those people into solutions that are really going to help when we have maybe two different opinions about it. And that's something that greatly concerns me, where I think civility would play a role as far as just not the right thing to do, but as far as effectively seeking solutions to this incredibly difficult problem.
Great. Next question, please.
Thank you. So you guys are free to correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me that there are two things that you all mostly agree on, in that regardless of whether politics have gotten more or less civil recently, we have lacked civility in government to some extent for a long time, and that more civility in government would be good. So my question to you is there anything that the government itself can do to increase civility without infringing upon free speech, or is it the responsibility of politicians to use more civil tactics, even though they know that the results they'll get from those tactics are less effective than less civil methods?
Be a structural change is what he's suggesting.
Well, and I think that's really the essence of the question here, because I find a policy change for exactly the reasons you suggest, given free speech, very difficult to come up with. Even when it comes to the right to lie in your speech, you know, I mean, there's a certain amount of protection we all have in our free speech. But on the other hand, what you're asking, and what we are all implicitly asking, I think, when we talk about civility to some extent, is to disengage with a set of tactics that may work, right? So I don't know if negativity works. The research is a bit sort of mixed on that, so I'll withhold completely agreeing with myself here on this point. But at the same time, people think it works. And so if you decided, well, I'm going to engage in a civil campaign and I'm not going to attack my opposition, the other side senses blood and knows that if they can also attack, then they're going to have a disparity of message flows that may work to their benefit. So and so that incentivizes people to play the same game. We see that in outside spending. You know, Obama's super PAC spent tons of money promoting him, even though the Democrats are ostensibly against Citizens United. The way to attack ads is more ads. So, I mean, it's very hard to disengage with a set of tactics that work. But ultimately, it is really the only solution, because if government comes in and says, you know, we can't step on each other's toes, we can't lie in our ads, we can't lie in our discourse, there's a constitutional challenge there.
But isn't that what this covenant is designed to do, is to try to operationalize exactly that? And so while this doesn't come out of our you know, government structure, you've got, you know, this coming out of our faith traditions, or faith leaders are trying to get this covenant signed so that there is this not mandated agreement about civility, but there's certainly an agreed upon way to rules of engagement. So, I mean, one of the things I'd be curious to know is who signed the covenant here in Maine and who hasn't, because that may give us an indication about a lot of things with this current campaign. So who signed it? Put those names out there, and also put the names out there of who hasn't signed it. Now, that would be a telling story.
Mm-hmm. You can go on MaineCouncilOfChurches.org and read the list. I don't know how many have signed it to date, but I think in the 70s or 80s out of 104 out of 435 local, state, and national candidates.
It's going to shoot up after this panel, after it's aired.
And I think it's both important to know who signed it, but then it's important to hold them accountable. I mean, again, there are campaigns and then there's governing, and there really are different things. Now, sometimes the blood from the campaign flows, but remember, the person that you beat in a campaign, you're not serving with. So there's no bad feelings in that body, and you've got to figure out. Now, sometimes there's bad feelings against a party or how that might work, but governing and campaigning are very, very different. And that's the place that you can probably get to in terms of trying to hold people more accountable if there's a civility you want. But again, it's, I think ultimately what we want is progress, and we want good policy. And however, whatever helps us get there, right? I mean, Lyndon Johnson was a very different kind of politician, and we really might not agree with a lot of the tactics that he used to pass the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Now, am I glad he got that through? Absolutely. Now, if I had to really look at what he did in order to get there, I probably would not like that, and I would not call that civil. But I am glad that he got it done. So there's an issue of what ultimately must be accomplished. If, you know, I don't buy into this philosophy today that people say that Obama, you know, he needs to let John Boehner win more golf games, and if that happened, we'd all of a sudden have all kinds of legislation passed. I think that's baloney. I just don't think it has anything to do with Obama being nicer to somebody. There's ideological divides that are going on, and there's a battle between these two sides that's trying to be won by whatever tactics they can use. And I hope that the side that I agree with wins more often.
Well, before I forget, Heidi, if you'd like to give us the web address for the Civility Covenant again for our listeners.
Maine, all spelled out. MaineCouncilOfChurches.org.
Great. Well, this has been really wonderful, very substantive chat. I want to thank the audience for coming tonight. I want to thank the Maine Council of Churches for co-sponsoring it. And I'd like to thank Ethan, Rachel, Heidi, Michael, and Carol. We have a small gift and a round of applause, please.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on MPBN. Today's panel discussion on civil discourse and politics was presented by the Colby College Goldfarb Center for Public Affairs and Civic Engagement. The program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time. You can also listen to the program again at any time by accessing it on our website, mpbn.net. Click on Audio on Demand or Podcasts to hear this program and many other archived Speaking in Maine programs, as well as highlights from our Your Vote 2014 election coverage. Charles Beck is the executive producer of Speaking in Maine. For Speaking in Maine and MPBN Radio, I'm Jonathan Woodward.